Anyway, so today, actually, we have Chudini Reddy, who is going to talk about from women on the loose to women in the lead, Indian nurses, imperialism, and the politics of immigration. She's this year's Thomas Tam, visiting professor of Asian American Studies at the Grad Center here. And she normally teaches at SUNY Old Westbury in American Studies. Dr. Reddy's work focuses on history of U.S. imperialism, immigration, and South Asian diaspora, as well as mass criminalization, immigrant rights, transnational feminism, and struggles for liberation. She is the author of Nursing and Empire, Gendered Labor and Migration from India to the United States, and co-editor of The Sun Never Sets, South Asian Migrants in an Age of U.S. Power. And both books are also published in South Asia. So I welcome her up.
I want to start with a round of thank yous for all of the people and places that made this event possible. First, I want to thank the Asian and Asian American Research Institute here at CUNY, which sponsors the Thomas Tam professorship, which is what I have this year. And particularly, I want to thank Joyce Moy, Anthony Wong, and Russell Leong at ARI. And I also want to thank the Department of Sociology and the Immigrant Seminar Series and Margaret for inviting me to give this talk today. And then last but not least, I want to thank all of you for showing up and engaging me in dialogue. So the talk is based on my book, Nursing and Empire, Gendered Labor and Migration from India to the United States. And that book was published in 2015 at the University of North Carolina Press. And it's a history book, and this is sociology department, so I just want to forewarn you that I'm an American Studies scholar. My degree is in American Studies as well as my current institutional location. But I also, I guess, if anything, I tell stories more than compile data, but I'm welcoming this interdisciplinary discussion. And in many ways, this project really grew up alongside my own evolution as a scholar of American studies, one who was learning the tools of that non-discipline at a time when the field was embracing a transnational approach and also evolving into one of the most vibrant locations for critical and comparative ethnic studies in the academy, right? And in my research for this book, I combine archival materials, secondary sources, and life history interviews that I conducted with Indian nurse immigrants in the United States, mostly in the New York metropolitan area, but some in other parts of the U.S. And while I don't privilege any form of source material over any other, in many ways, the interviews are really what's at the heart of the book. And it's the words of nurses that led me into certain archives, and their stories and their silences helped me to pose many of the problems that I set out to analyze in the book. So the second contextual piece for the book is that it really also grew out of my deep involvement in the growth of South Asian American scholarship, activism, and art in the New York metro area at the turn of this past century, so the 90s and the aughts. At the time, we, those of us who were involved in those circles, were simultaneously coming out and being disappeared, depending on who we were, right? So it was both the coming out of my generation, which was the first generation to be born and or primarily raised in the United States after the major overhaul in U.S. immigration law in 1965. Right. So we were kind of coming of age around the 90s and aughts and starting to make our mark in politics and art and things like that. And then also, of course, it was the onset of the post 9/11 war on terror, which happened both in South Asia and the Middle East, as well as here domestically in the United States. And so what that meant was that brown bodies both were and are being bombed still there and being detained and deported here, right? Disappeared in that kind of terrorized thing. And so this is all the context, even though none of this is directly in the book, because the book is not about, it's about a 100-year period that ends in the 80s, and it's about nurse immigration. Really, that context and being involved in those communities of resistance helped me frame the questions that I asked. And so it's in the book. It's just not in the book in a way that you can read directly. And so as I sat down to think about how I would present this information to you here today, I'm thinking about how the current context may or may not reshape the way we approach the material or what it means or what significance we can draw from it. So I'm thinking of two things, of course. the kind of centrality of an anti-immigrant platform to the candidacy and presidency of Donald Trump, and the way in which that has kind of raised awareness for people who maybe haven't been thinking about these things for as long, about the crisis in immigration in the United States right now. And the way, you know, if you know the history, and I'm happy to talk more about this, a lot of things are continuities with what's been going on for a really long time, but some of the differences, or not even the differences, but some of the emphases that have come out more is the longstanding centrality of white supremacy to the politics of national reproduction in the United States, and how those are more brazen now in some ways than they have been in a while, right? Although they've been consistent. And also, we're at the same time, we're at this moment where questions around power, gender, and sexuality are back into the mainstream political discourse. With the Me Too movement, a lot of the things around rape, sexual harassment, banning of transgender people in the military. And so, you know, the relationship between immigration, sex, and work is actually all at the heart of my book, because any discussion about nursing is a discussion about a historically gendered, racialized, sexualized form of work, right? And how it is both unpaid in the home and then how it moves into hospitals and the healthcare system and is paid, right? So there's really, in a way, those contexts are very directly related to the topic at hand. And so with that as a kind of framing device to move into the heart of the book, I want to begin in a really blunt way. And so please excuse my crassness, because I'm going to begin by removing a piece of shit. But don't listen to me. In the words of Doctor of Education and registered nurse Suresh Khanna, Dr. Suresh Khanna, quote, "The old man was brought into the minor OR for a rectal examination. He was crying with severe pain in the abdomen. He said with folded hands, 'Miss, give me something to relieve this unbearable pain. I am dying with this. I cannot take it anymore. Please help me.'" End of quote. After the rectal examination, the doctor diagnosed him as having, end of the quote of the man, not of the nurse. After the rectal examination, the doctor diagnosed him as having an impacted rectum. He ordered an enema, which was given instantly with no result. The patient kept on crying as there was added pressure with the enema water and nothing else was coming out except the enema water. At that time, I decided to wear a glove and do a manual removal of the feces from the rectum. The decision was based upon the rationale that the removal of some feces will make room for another enema, which will help the patient. Believe me or not, there were two loaded kidney basins of hard pieces, like rocks, of feces. The rectum was not emptied totally because there was danger of a sudden release of pressure from the abdomen. The minor OR was full of the foul smell. The doctor came running and saw that scene, which brought such relief to the patient. Until today, it gives me so much satisfaction to think about the incident and the gratifying outcome. That's the end of the quote from the nurse. The story is from Dr. Khanna's book, which is called The History of Nursing in India, 1947 to 1989, which she gave to me as a gift during our interview in 2003. It is a recollection from her early days in nursing school at Irwin Hospital in New Delhi, India, and it is singular among the accounts I heard over the course of my research, for very few scenes, really no scene, could evoke the stigmatization of nurses and nursing experienced by my interviewees and their cohort more clearly than the predicament of the old man in the OR. While no others would go into such vivid detail, most nurses would at least admit that at the time when they entered nursing school, which was the mid-20th century for most of them, they struggled against nursing's deep association with the dirty work of dealing with the human body's most intimate functions. On the Indian subcontinent, these tasks also have a strong association with ritual pollution and work historically relegated to dominant Hindu society's outcasts, so Dalits, right? Ex-untouchables. Dalit is the name they give themselves. Untouchable is the name that dominant Hindu society gives them. Nurses thus came to be looked down upon as the loose and lowly women who dare to perform this work often outside of caste boundaries. So in this view, no good girl could be a nurse, because she would not circulate in public, unregulated, tending to men outside her family, and, what is worse, dealing with their most untouchable parts. Only families desperate for money would allow their women to do such deeds, adding nursing to the shaming effects of poverty and a lack of male economic authority. Nursing thus came to be associated with a certain kind of prostitution, of poor women who do dirty work for others, especially other men. In other words, it became a focal point for anxieties over what happens when women are on the loose, outside the hold of patriarchal family structures and their caste, class, sexual, and gender norms. This was certainly the case for Dr. Khanna, who entered nursing school at a time when it was unheard of girls, quote, especially from Hindu families, especially Punjabis, unquote, to become nurses. She described to me how the neighbors were just telling my mother that she will not get married. She's in the mortuary working with dead people. She is giving enemas, all sorts of rotten things they will present to her instead of giving her the good picture. End quote. The neighbors' warnings reinforce, point by point, the anxiety around women on the loose. In this particular case, the scandal of nursing was also a sign of the community's newly destabilized status. Dr. Khanna comes from a family of Hindu Punjabis who were partition refugees. They had relocated to New Delhi, the capital of India, during the violent subdivision of the Indian subcontinent into the nation-states of India and Pakistan in 1947. For them, freedom from British rule had materialized through loss. Loss of property, possessions, family, and friends. Consequently, it was also a moment of real downward mobility and the adjustment to a lower class, if not caste, status. Within this context, the young Suwersha's entry into nursing could be read as a sign of the degree of her family's dispossession, where loss of property is also read as loss of propriety. But things have changed. When I met Dr. Khanna in 2003, she had forestalled retirement and was jetting between India and the U.S. in her position as the director of a 21st century private nursing college in India. With her career still in motion and on the cutting edge, she described to me how she receives accolades from the very same family and friends who had initially scared her mother. Now those people turn around, including my relatives. They say, oh, she is a goddess. Everybody will be calling, get us this appointment, get us that appointment. Still, I do not have a grudge or hard feelings. I just pity them more. They were ignorant. That's all I can say. Over the course of our conversation, it became clear to me that Dr. Khanna does more than pity her erstwhile detractors and their sanctioned ignorance. She challenges them. This comes through clearly in her rewriting of the original scene of her supposed defilement. She rewrites into a scene displaying her medical daring and expertise. It also comes through in her efforts to, quote, go forward with this and not to be stationary with the nursing diploma, end quote. A determination that took her from Delhi to Canada and finally to New York, where in 1979 she earned her doctorate degree at Teachers College, Columbia University. Neither did her commitment to a career in caring prevent Suwersh from getting married and raising a family in the suburbs of New York City. Over the years, the Khanna's home has also served as a hub for many of the meetings and gatherings that have marked her role in building a community of Indian nurses and their families in the New York metropolitan area. So Suwersh Khanna's orientation towards building community is also a central part of her project in this book, The History of Nursing in India. It culminates with an appendix highlighting members of the Nursing Honor Society of India, which is a group that she founded to honor nurses left out of the Indian government's award system. So Khanna Society focuses on the accomplishments of Indian nurses living abroad, primarily in North America, as well as, though to a lesser extent, nurses who work in private hospitals in India. So taken together, the portraits of the inductees to her society present a collective challenge to the anxiety produced around women on the loose in the world of waged work. Dr. Khanna and her cohort pose this challenge from their position in what I will call a diaspora of decolonization. They are nurses who emigrated out of independent India during the Cold War as part of the mass transfer of skilled Indian labor to the United States at that time. Until recently, attention to their immigration pattern has been overshadowed by the physicians, scientists, and engineers who were the object of brain drain scares emanating from India and model minority adulation propagating in the United States. And yet, nurses' absorption into these narratives, their invisibility within them, has really obscured the ways in which their migration differed significantly from their other professional managerial compatriots. First, India's pool of internationally mobile nursing labor was dominated by women. It drew heavily from India's minority Christian communities and its southernmost states, especially the state of Kerala, and its lower middle classes, right? So all of those are different than the doctors and the scientists and the engineers. Even though women were prevalent in those other strains, they were more or less led by men and or led by the nuclear family formation and also did not come from the lower middle classes or predominantly Hindu Christian communities. So to an Indian, those markers make a lot of sense, is how it's different. But just so you know, that's different than the North Indian male, sort of more middle to upper middle class migration. So, in addition, and as indicated by Dr. Khanna's story, at mid-20th century, nursing in India remained an overwhelmingly ill-regarded and ill-paid occupation. So when these same workers, these nurses, immigrated to the United States, they entered a market where registered nursing had achieved the status of a profession, right? And while professional nursing in the U.S. remained stratified and embattled, for Indian nurses at the time, immigration equaled professionalization in a manner that did not apply to other members of their Cold War immigrant cohort. So the promise of professionalization also distinguished nurses from their own families and communities. For few other members of India's lower middle classes possessed skills that could translate into upward mobility as readily on the international labor market. Nurses thus led emigration out of their communities, and they also often remained the primary income earners in their families that reformed through resettlement. So immigration to the United States transformed nurses from women on the loose into women on the lead. Okay, that's the title of the talk. But women on the lead, in the lead rather, is a Janus-faced figure. On the one hand, she symbolizes the economic opportunities and institutional access promised by immigration to the United States. These are surely part of what triggered the change response from Dr. Khanna's long-distance friends and family. Get us this appointment, get us that appointment. At the same time, the female dominance characterizing nurse immigration has also been a source for renewed fears about the potentially unchecked power of women in the lead. That this is so came across quite clearly in the very first story that I recorded for this project. It was told to me by Vasantha Daniel, who is a retired nurse educator based in Washington State. The story was not entirely her own. It had been told to her by her friend Joe. That's not his real name. Joe is a former nurse recruiter and fellow member of the Indian immigrant community in the greater Seattle area. His story takes place in the early 1970s, which are kind of the golden years for nurse immigration from India to the United States. This was after the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act amendments included nursing within its occupational preference quotas, meaning that nurses could arrive in the U.S. with a green card, which is permanent legal residency, already in hand. It was also following the post-World War II liberalization of U.S. immigration law, which lifted the race-based exclusion that had prohibited Indian labor from legal immigration since 1917. So Daniel explained to me that in the midst of the ensuing immigration frenzy, many nurses had difficulty in navigating the set of professional tests and job opportunities that had opened up. And so a business of nurse recruiting sprung up around them. Recruiters promised to take care of all of the paperwork and secure a job and a green card, all for a fee, of course. In many cases, nurses continued to pay off these fees while working in the U.S., while working in the United States. So Joe's story concerns a young Indian nurse who had come to the U.S. at that time through the help of a recruiter. As it turned out, the recruiter not only knew of a job, he also knew of a man. He knew of a man in New Delhi who was trying to come to the U.S. And so he approached our nameless nurse with a proposal. Would she marry this man so that he could gain entry and then legal residency in the United States? The deal was that the marriage would be on paper only, and that once her husband got his green card, she could divorce him and they could both be on their merry ways, no strings attached. So in other words, it would be a typical green card marriage. The nurse agreed. However, things started to go awry after the marriage because the nurse refused to grant a divorce. As the story goes, she had decided that her husband was just too good looking to let go of. Unfortunately, her husband was apparently not so smitten. And as soon as he got his green card, he left her. But his wife did not let him off so easy. She tracked him down, reportedly, only to have him disappear. She tracked him down repeatedly, only to have him disappear repeatedly. Eventually, as Daniel explained, her husband just, quote, didn't know what to do. He got so desperate. So he said, how am I going to get rid of this woman? Thank you. How am I going to get rid of this woman? Then he joined the armed forces and went away. But, you know, she wouldn't keep quiet. She said, well, I'm not going to let him get off that easy. So she somehow tracked him down through the recruiting office somewhere and reported to the armed services that here was her husband who had deserted her, hadn't written or contacted her for so many months or years or whatever. I don't know how the story ends. I told Joe to let me know, but I don't know. End quote. So that's where Daniel's retelling ends, kind of trailing off inconclusively, concealing as much as it reveals. Indeed, filtered through multiple narrators, the story's details are hard to pin down. What sort of obligations was the nurse under to her recruiter? To whom does she really appeal? How might the U.S. Armed Forces respond to the charge that one of its immigrant members had deserted his immigrant wife? And ultimately, does our nurse get her man? Or does he disappear according to his own plan? We do not know, right? And in some ways, the facts are not what's at stake here. Instead, Joe's story is best understood as a tall tale, a fabulous fable made for the telling and retelling. And like every good fable, it has its moral. When told to and by nurse recruiters and or male immigrants, it fairly screams, buyer beware. The nurse with a ticket to ride shall have your hide. Visions of the castrating female are really front and center here, mitigated only by Daniel's own refusal and or inability to give us the ending. Her uncertainty opens the possibility for multiple outcomes, including possibly happy ones. Even so, the story as it stands provides clear evidence of the anxiety that attached gendered and sexualized relationships in this immigration pattern. Significantly, it is an anxiety not based solely on nurses' access to the U.S. labor market. It is also very much tied to their ability to access the family reunification provisions that are at the heart of the 1965 liberalization of U.S. immigration law, and still to this day, right, because the law hasn't been overhauled since then. So throughout my interview process, I heard example after example of female nurses who came to sponsor their spouses and, by extension, their entire families and communities. Indeed, it is precisely the institutional and economic empowerment of our anonymous nurse recruit that once again raises the specter of women on the loose and returns her through an anxiety over women in the lead. How am I going to get rid of this woman? Indeed. So the persistent degradation of the labor of nursing and of Indian nurses is one clear cause for their near absence from the historical archives and statistical records. On the flip side, when and where nurses have come into view, it has been in no small part through an analysis of their stigmatization. So there's a book by a sociologist, When Women Come First, Gender and Class in Transnational Migration. Her name is Sheba Miriam George. And she also identifies the reproduction of nurses' stigmatization within immigrant communities. And she attributes it to the transmission of status differences from India to the United States through contemporary transnational circuits, i.e. the forms of media and information technology that mark this latest phase of global capitalism. Right? So that's how the stigma persists in the diaspora. While these circuits continue to connect immigrants to India, they also function as silos that are somehow separate from the larger context of the United States. So the stigmatization of Indian nurses is thus a resolutely Indian phenomenon, tied to the transmission of Indian culture through the airwaves, and one that cannot be explained in relation to the social structures of the United States, where, George argues, nursing has a more solidly professional status. In other words, there is an implication that for Indian nurses, the United States is a land of opportunity, and it is the global resilience of certain elements of Indian culture that remains the problem. The seemingly strict separation between Indian and U.S. social formation is a product of what George's work actually shares with general analyses of skilled Indian labor immigration that have, regardless of their particular subject or argument, remained bound by the explanatory powers of U.S. immigration law. Thus, the critical lever in her account, and those it takes its lead from, is the passage of the 1965 Immigration Act. This exclusive emphasis on U.S. immigration law obscures the participation of the United States and U.S. interests in global histories of capitalist imperialism, and thus reduces the complexities of migrants' decisions as they are made, and at least in part, in relationship to the machinations of this global system. Right? Instead, immigration to the U.S. begins when migrants are allowed to legally land on U.S. shores, and their decision to do so is based on individualized economic considerations that coincide with the ideological promise of the American dream. Ultimately, such a formulation plays directly into the paradigm of American exceptionalism, the view that the United States is a nation in isolation that stands apart from, even as it is a beacon for, the rest of the world. What is more, in this case, it does so in order to describe the movement of a workforce that was actually established through the participation of U.S. individuals and institutions in the British-dominated colonization of the Indian subcontinent. Here we must remember that hospital nursing as we now know it was not a universal development, nor was it indigenous to the Indian subcontinent. Instead, it is a culturally specific practice, one that grew up out of the detritus of the witch hunts of medieval Europe and spread around the world on the wings of capitalist imperialism. The stigmatization of Indian nurses as women on the loose was thus forged in the crucible of colonization. Nursing an Empire, the book, thus begins in the 19th century on an Indian subcontinent that was the jewel in the crown of the British Empire, with the reminder that the colonization of India and Indians was never an exclusively British affair. Indeed, when it comes to the establishment of hospital nursing, Protestant medical missions were the primary institutions to educate and employ the first pool of Indian nursing labor, and U.S. missions were absolutely central to this development. The Reverend Dr. John Scudder Sr. was both the first medical missionary ever deputed by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions and the first medical missionary to work in India. He arrived in 1836, was part of a movement that made U.S. missionaries second only to their British brethren on the subcontinent. The prominence of U.S. medical missionaries, in particular, continued through the feminization of medical missionary work in the late 19th century. So in 1869, Dr. Clara Swain became the first female medical missionary deputed from the United States and the first to work in India. Again, it's like the direction is the same. At the time of her arrival, the male-dominated medical establishment in the United States had only reluctantly begun to open itself up to women practitioners. So these earliest women graduates faced a restricted, if not outrightly hostile, field here in the United States. In contrast, the colonial field, or colonies, the Anglo-American colonies, provided them with professional mobility, autonomy, and authority. In India, they not only had their own practices, which they founded, some also founded and or led institutions that grew into hospitals and colleges. The Vellore Christian Medical College, founded by Dr. Ida Sophia Scudder, she's the granddaughter of the first Scudder that I mentioned, remains one of the top two biomedical institutions in India to this day. It was one of the many female medical missions that were the central incubators of colonial nursing in India. At the turn of the 20th century, when female medical missions expanded beyond the capacity of a single woman's control, leadership did not pass into the hands of Indian employees. Instead, space opened up for the migration of metropolitan nurses at a time when their status as professionals was at best incipient. That's nurses from Europe and North America. In North America, the United Kingdom, and Europe, nurses were still largely considered loose and lowly women at this time. It was this taint, in part, that colonial nurses migrated to India to mitigate. In India, their status was based on the racialized hierarchies of colonial rule and materialized through the insistent, institutionalized subordination of their Indian employees. Colonial characterizations of Indian nurses as degraded and degrading thus combined with poor working conditions at mission institutions to brand Indian nurses as women on the loose. This is where this comes from. This is not to say that gender, class, and caste-based hierarchies amongst Indians played no role in this stigmatization. It is instead to situate these within processes of colonization that remade the meaning and function of Indian social norms as they impacted the formation of this colonial occupation. So in other words, I'm raising some questions about caste as not being this essential static thing, but as being transformed, the way we think of race as being transformed in the United States, as being transformed through social formation in India, right? And remade through processes of colonization. So it's critical to note that in order to reap the rewards of missionary migration, female doctors and nurses had to remain single. Otherwise, their status as paid workers would threaten a Christian civilizing mission that relied on the ideal of a white heteropatriarchal nuclear family replete with a male breadwinner and a female breadbaker. White women workers thus faced a choice between careers where they could work for wages or marriage where their labors, at the mission or in the home, would be without pay. If they chose to work for wages, the question remained of how to frame their sexuality in a way that would not threaten domesticated ideals of Victorian femininity. So the solution to this came through this global cry of women's work for women, which animated Protestant missions over the turn of the 20th century and positioned single female medical missionaries and nurses as the anointed saviors of black and brown women. Within the institutional context of female Protestant medical missions in India, what this meant was that authority was figured through a kind of racialized matriarchy. So white women who were single and therefore could not channel their sexuality in a quote-unquote normal way would channel their maternal instincts through their tutelage of Indian women as students, employees, and patients. And it was hoped, because the ultimate goal was Christian converts. Right, so this is it. The ability of white women to occupy this role left Indian nurses with the burden of being waged workers who, even if married, could not fulfill an imperial feminine ideal. It contributed to the conditions for their castigation. Now, there's much more to be said about the evolution of colonial nursing in India up through independence and partition in 1947, after which Indians slowly but surely began to access upward mobility through the roots of colonial medicine's remade global map, right? It wasn't just India where Protestant missions were critical in establishing what we know as biomedicine. It was across a lot of the colonies. But today, I will just have time to mention that the remaking of colonial medicine, what we now know as biomedicine, in both the United States and around the world, was stewarded by the Rockefeller Foundation during the decades between World War I and World War II. I go into this in much more detail in my book. I'm like obsessed with the Rockefeller Foundation. But here, I want to make note of two things. The first is that by examining the work of U.S. Protestant missionaries and the Rockefeller Foundation, we expand the terrain of where and how we can ask questions of U.S. imperialism. In this, I will follow upon the heels of the work of scholars such as historian Catherine Siniza Choi, who in her Empire of Care makes the connection between U.S. colonialism and Filipino nurse immigration to the United States, Filipinos being the primary immigrant nurse group in the U.S. In the case of the Philippines, which remains the largest source of foreign nurse immigrants to the U.S., the argument in many ways rests upon the fact of U.S. territorial colonization of the islands. Just as Britain once had India, the U.S. once had the Philippines. In contrast, examining the role of U.S. institutions, individuals, and ideologies in British-dominated India raises a different set of questions. In what ways can the subcontracting of certain duties of the colonial civilizing mission, women's work for women, be understood as an arena for shifts in the infrastructure of colonial power? Here I pay particular attention to the way in which the Rockefeller Foundation navigated the same cracks in the colonial government that were offered to the Indian nationalist elite between World War I and World War II. That is to say, in the period that was right before Indian independence and partition. As scientific medicine became part of the package of decolonization embraced by the Indian nationalist elite, the singular imprint of the Rockefeller Foundation on the way we can understand the critical the Rockefeller Foundation's singular imprint is crucial to understanding how we can for situating how we can understand the critical cumulative role that U.S.-based institutions played in India. So, in some ways, I think that the work of the Rockefeller Foundation is a rehearsal for what would become the American century and for this kind of Cold War transfer of power from Britain to the United States. Now, the second and not unrelated point that I want to touch on is how turning to the work, and you can ask me more about that, is turning to the work of the Rockefeller Foundation also raises the question of the relationship between the institutionalization of Jim Crow segregation in the United States and the shifting contours of Anglo-American capitalist imperialism on the global scale. Because critically, the work of the foundation was central in both arenas, and its officers saw them as related. So I examine this in particular in relation to Rockefeller's promotion of public health, which functioned explicitly as a secularized medical mission for Rockefeller's medical men. Rockefeller Foundation was behind the remaking of medical education in the United States and of public health. So what we, like the university-based, research-centered medical education in the U.S. is completely a product of corporate philanthropy, right? And Jim Crow segregation, especially in healthcare, was largely funded by them. So in terms of public health, the Rockefeller Foundation's first major venture in this arena was towards the eradication of hookworm in the U.S. South. This is after the Civil War, after the end of the Civil War, during Reconstruction and shortly thereafter. Here, foundation officers worked off the theory that hookworm, which they also called the germ of laziness, had been brought to the South by enslaved Africans, which was why formerly enslaved Africans suffered from it far less than the poor Southern whites who they infected and who had not built up generations of immunity. However, when the Rockefeller Foundation's vision shifted to the global stage in general and to the British Empire in particular, the Rockefeller Foundation wanted to make inroads into the British Empire, but they didn't do it by wanting to take over colonies. They did it by wanting to enter in through arenas that the British were not good at funding, health being one of them, right? Because they neglected the health of their colonial subjects. So when Rockefeller shifted towards the British Empire, the source of hookworm, or the germ of laziness, also shifted from enslaved Africans to indentured Indians. And Indian coolies, foundation officers exclaimed, were the primary bearers of hookworm into the United States and indeed around the world. And this also coincided with the anti-immigrant, anti-Asian movements that were targeting Indian, Chinese, Japanese labor. So this happens at the same time as that. So by identifying the disease with Indians, the Rockefeller Foundation secured a scare tactic that would allow for the spread of its own public health work across the British Empire, including, of course, Mother India. At the same time, and we're here in the decades surrounding World War I, the rhetoric of coolies as the cause, like I said, also fed into anti-Asian movements that were focused especially on Indian laborers and succeeded in banning our entry in 1917, right, and then banning the right for any Asian to naturalize in 1923-24. So I just made mention to Mother India, which is both a figure of speech and also the title of a book by the Rockefeller-funded U.S. journalist Catherine Mayo. And her book sent shockwaves across India, the U.S., and the United Kingdom after its publication in 1927 because it has really lurid details of deviant Indian sexuality and especially degraded and degrading Hindu Indian women, positioning both Indian sexuality and Hindu Indian women as the root cause for the inability of Indians to rule ourselves. So with this book, Mayo fanned the flames that continue to identify the state of Indian women as the justification for colonization on the subcontinent. Earlier, when the missionaries female missionaries were entering India, they were like, you know, Indian women are locked away in the home. The men won't let them out. The only people who can get in to treat them, especially during childbirth where they're all dying, are other women. They're not going to let foreign men in. So this was the argument for women against women. And Mayo is kind of resuscitating that argument for a new time period by saying that it's these women who are locked away and their lurid sexuality that is making Indian men incapable of ruling the country, and therefore India can't rule itself. That was what was going on there. And so at the same time, and on the other side of the world, Mayo stoked the fires of anti-Asian rhetoric that continued to construct Asian sexualities in the United States as inherently deviant and threatening to the white American body politic, even after legal exclusion had been achieved. So this helped to solidify a stockpile of images demonizing Asian women and Asian sexualities that persisted even through the period when Asian exclusion was being overturned through processes of inclusion. So with this, and there's a lot that I'm skipping over here, so please ask me about any of it. With this, I really want to return once again to the golden years of the 1970s when professional managerial Indian immigrants became the stock and trade of the Asian American model minority. And it's a stereotype that relies as much on a configuration of gender and sexuality as it does on a combination of race and class. These are not just professional managerial migrants. They are also nuclear families, right, constructed by the family reunification provisions of U.S. immigration law. And so scholars of Asian Pacific America have provided us with ample critique of this image of the model minority, reminding us of the ways in which U.S. immigration law selected Asian immigrants to succeed through its occupational preference quotas, right? And when these immigrants reached middle class status and heretofore unprecedented speed and ease, you're either the green card, move to the suburbs, you have a job, boom. Right? U.S. media outlets and scholars promoted them as the image of what could be achieved in the post-civil rights United States, with the implication that African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and other impoverished communities of color were to blame for their own lack of advancement. Right? The culture of poverty argument. The counterpart to the model minority argument is the culture of poverty argument. These arose at the same time to explain the persistence of inequality in the post-civil rights United States through cultural terms. So it's worth remembering also that the culture of poverty argument leveled against internal communities of color was also, and in many ways, primarily an argument against allegedly broken because female-dominated family forms, giving rise to the image of black and brown welfare queens as a drain on U.S. society. So it is against this backdrop that I want to return to Joe's story of the green card marriage gone awry, in order to position its portrayal of our nameless nurse within this longer history of the demonization of Indian women as degraded and degrading and deserving of colonization, Asian women as dragon ladies who are here to kind of corrupt the U.S. body politic, and the post-civil rights stigmatization of racialized female-dominated family and kinship networks in the United States. So all of this is context for that. It's not just something that's about this one particular group of immigrants. So my move to telescope out of the internal workings of Indian nurse immigrant communities into the arena of U.S. racial formation, understood as an imperial formation, is hardly a stretch. In fact, by 1986, a moral panic over immigrant family formation once again provoked the exclusionary powers of the U.S. Congress when it passed the Immigration Marriage Fraud Amendments. At stake in debates over the immigration marriage fraud amendments was the alleged abuse of spousal reunification's priority in U.S. immigration law, a priority that had its origins in the attempt to rectify the nation-based quotas that had restricted Southern and Eastern European immigrants from 1924 to 1965. Again, you can ask me more about that. But part of the reason why family reunification is central is that the imagination of lawmakers at the time was that those from Europe, from Southern and Eastern Europe, who had been excluded by quotas would then be able to reunite with their family members who had been kept out. Lawmakers raised fears that 20 years after its sanctification, immigration via marriage was turning from a means for family reunification for Europe's unfairly excluded to a cottage industry channelizing otherwise illegal, undesirable, and excluded persons into the U.S. The cure to this underground economy, those are quotes from the hearings, was not to eliminate spousal preferences, but instead to distinguish between good and bad marriages. The former, good, were recognized as a pillar of U.S. values and virtue. The latter, bad, were identified as threats to that same nation. In order to underscore this, congressmen listened to the testimonies of four citizens who had been duped by smooth-talking aliens. Aliens is the legal term for non-citizen migrant in the U.S. Notably, one of those who testified was Miss Amita Narulwala, a U.S. citizen of Indian origin. In his introduction to her testimony, Senator Alan K. Simpson, Republican from Wyoming, notes that, in keeping with the common practice of India, her family arranged for her marriage to a young doctor who was still living in India. The testimony then turns over to Miss Narulwala, who describes how she returned to her native Bombay in 1982 for her marriage. 2 days later, the Indian consulate granted her now husband a U.S. visa. She continues, quote, "Well, once we entered into the United States, he is a psychiatrist. His attitude, you know, turned completely to be professional, and he disregarded our personal life completely, went off to obtain a job in the United States. Then he left me in October, so we've been married 3 months. He left in October, and in January was the first time he called me and let me know at that time that he had married me for a green card and he had nothing. He did not want to have anything to do with me. After that, he has changed his address, and so I could not locate him. And we had to hire a sheriff who located him for us, and I delivered an annulment paper which was based upon marriage fraud. The courts disregarded that, and I sent him divorce papers, which he disregarded. And I have been to the INS, Senator Hines, Senator, I have spoken to your committee, I have spoken to Congressman Goodling, I have been to INS at least 50 times. This is when it was Immigration Nationalization Services, not Immigration Customs Enforcement, putting in requests, asking them to look this matter over, and have had no results," end quote. Nothing in Ms. Narulwala's testimony indicates how she herself got her U.S. citizenship. We can, however, make several solid assumptions based on the available material. First, the fact that she is of Indian origin, that her parents remain in India, and that she appears to have naturalized, not through family reunification, indicates that she is probably a labor immigrant herself. The arrangement of her marriage to an Indian doctor involves her story in the circuits of international and Indian medical migration and suggests that she, too, is possibly a medical immigrant himself, either a doctor or nurse, maybe a doctor. Given the time frame, the early 1980s, the chances that she's either a female physician or nurse are high. In either case, the fact that she fits the profile of a woman in the lead is clear. Right? Indeed, the details of her post-marriage dilemma resonate very eerily with those of the unnamed nurse in the tale that came to me through Vasantha Daniel and her friend, the nurse recruiter, Joe. The primary difference is that in Joe's story, the nurse ostensibly knew what she was getting into, and in this case, Ms. Narulwala apparently did not. At the end of her testimony, Senator Simpson asks Ms. Narulwala if there's anything else about her marriage that she would like to add, and the following exchange ensues. So this is Ms. Narulwala. "Sir, I did find a letter that he had written to his parents, and in the letter it basically stated he had written it to his parents and was getting ready to mail it when I found it. And it stated that I have married you to obtain the green card, or I have married her to enter into this country primarily as a doctor, and I'm hoping to call all my family here and build our empire," end quote of the letter. "And so he will get his citizenship and bring his family here." Senator Simpson, he said, those were the words he used in the letter, "to build the empire." Ms. Narulwala, "Yes, sir." Senator Simpson, "I think that sometimes American citizens also forget that a person using the legal immigration systems of the United States and petitioning for relatives who are not in the United States can bring in relatives as, I don't want to use the word remote, but I will, because the American citizen, I think, thinks of a cohesive family or a nuclear family, as spouse and children, minor children, but to an Asian, it is the spouse, minor children, parents, brothers, sisters, and we have a preference called the fifth preference, which is brothers and sisters of adult U.S. citizens. And I do think we have a record holder in that area, one person who petitioned for 64 derivative relatives. That may be called building the empire, I think, and indeed, it is real. End quote. As Senator Simpson's speech progresses, it becomes clear that when he is referring to American citizens, he is no longer including Ms. Nariwala, in spite of the fact that she is naturalized. Instead, he distinguishes between American and Asian concepts of a family and how the one is what the law is meant to uphold and the other is how the law has been abused. When he stresses the word empire, he invokes the long association within U.S. political culture of Asian immigration and the fears of a yellow peril, which in this case has been rendered a shade of brown by Ms. Nariwala's national origins. And that sounds different now post-9/11 than it did pre-9/11, right? It effectively combined the fears, this yellow peril or brown peril, of military invasion, economic competition, and moral degeneracy to figure Asian immigrants as a conquering horde threatening to take over the U.S. national body. As mentioned already, deviant Asian sexuality was central to this threat. What Senator Simpson's speech implies by its set of associations and implications is that by the 1980s, the danger is of Asian family formation and its distinction from the cohesive nuclear family that lies at the heart of American values as reflected in U.S. immigration law. Significantly, the empire is now channeled through Asian women, who, being duped by their own husbands, become the channels through which their families propagate on U.S. soil as both workers and citizens. Over the course of the exchange between Ms. Amita Nariwala and Senator Simpson, the question of victimhood shifts from the abandoned and supplicating Asian immigrant woman to the offended and officiating U.S. nation state in a manner that strongly resonates with the history of racialized exclusion from the U.S. In this sense, it is indicative of the tenure of the hearings, for the testimony on record highlights repeatedly that individuals from Asia and or the Middle East are the perpetrators of marriage fraud. The charges of bad marriages as un-American thus came to be explicitly racialized over the course of the debates, with women in the lead being a particular vector for deviant social reproduction in the United States. Within this political context, it is impossible to read the stigmatization of Indian nurses as women in the lead as strictly a product of Indian culture. Instead, it is connected both to the making and remaking of anti-Asian discourse, understood as itself constitutive of normative U.S. culture, and even more specifically as connected to the normalization of the white, heteropatriarchal, nuclear family as the central reproductive unit of the United States. What is more, the outcasting of women of color, our families, and our communities occurred at a time of renewed anxiety about the sanctity of that normative center. Indeed, the Asian American model minority was not only a disciplinary tool used against impoverished communities of color, it was also a disciplinary tool that worked against the mass entry of middle-class white women into the U.S. workforce, reminding them, too, of what a good family looked like. This, in spite of the fact that Asian American model minority image also completely obscured the high workforce participation of Asian immigrant women themselves. The case of nursing is here especially relevant for the ways in which it straddles women's participation in the proliferation of skilled labor migration and the overall feminization of labor migration, especially, though not only, of the allegedly unskilled variety. So we're right now in the 70s and 80s during the shift towards service sector economy, which has more female-dominated migration across all levels, right? This nursing is almost like a little bit, the little occupational preference quota is like a vanguard of that. So in that sense, the problem of Indian nurses offers a window onto multiple intersecting and overlapping issues that lie at the core of the formation and reformation of the United States as an imperial nation, both at home and abroad. And, you know, I want to just – that's where the talk usually ends. I'm going to give you 2 minutes more, which is that I want to end by circling back to the what of this now that I began the talk with and just to foreground the key role that immigrant family formation has in the reproduction of the United States when we think about the Dreamers and DACA recipients and the sort of ways in which deportation is breaking apart families in really public ways, right, in the United States, families and communities, immigrant families and communities. And we get this kind of, you know, good family, bad family, worthy family, unworthy family in terms of who gets to stay together, right, and how. And so that's one thing that is definitely related to this long history that I just outlined. But the second part is also that, you know, to question the normativity that all sides of the debate, for the most part, place on the heteronormative nuclear family as the thing to be upheld, right? Whether it's black or brown or this or that. And so, you know, in this moment where we're questioning gender and sexuality and immigration altogether, I want to also raise the question of why that has to be the vector through which people immigrate into the United States and assimilate, right? And through the law as well as culturally. So I want to sort of think about undoing the heteronormative nuclear family as the horizon for justice and liberation. So that's my talk. I want to thank you for your time.
Any questions?
Do you have any idea about numbers? Historians, like sociologists, do like numbers.
Right.
And so from, say, the late 60s or early 70s through the end of
the Cold War,
do you have any idea of
the number
of nurses from India?
Off the top of my head, no. With all this story, I mean, I have some numbers in my book, but I don't like the question of numbers. Actually, is difficult because I remember looking for this, actually going through the census and stuff. And people don't always put down when they put down nurse, they don't always put down where they're from, and when they put down where they're from, they don't always put down nurse. So there are statistics, but there's also some difficulty in statistics. And the other difficulty with India nurses in particular is that India kept zero track of the emigration of them. There's absolutely no records from India because they were so dispensable in the Indian imaginary, right? That this was, and then in the U.S., I found that it was hard to piece together. For example, there's good statistics on Filipino nurses, and I wasn't able to find comparable ones. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. It just means that part of the difficulty of tracking this group is even comes down to the level of statistics, actually. But that's also that I don't remember the numbers that I came up with because I wrote the book. It was published in 2015. So it's like, it's old in my head. But they're certainly not the largest group. Largest group is Filipino. There are big numbers from the Caribbean also. Yeah,
that's our stereotype.
Yeah.
They are Filipino.
Filipino or Caribbean. But there are Indian nurses. And the fact that they're even...
Korean
also. And the fact that there are Indian nurses... And people think of Indian doctors when they think of medical migration, right? And there was no single group that was bigger on the global stage for mobility during the Cold War medically than Indian doctors, right? India sort of overproduced. So nurses are kind of hidden both within India but also within this other... Because they did exist in significant enough numbers that they were one of the major groups immigrating to the U.S. And so, yeah, that's kind of all I can say to
you.
Yeah. See if there are numbers there. Yes. Anybody else? Yeah.
Sorry, I missed the first part of it.
That's okay.
But I found it's really interesting. And I noticed you mentioned, like, Filipino, like, nurses. I wonder, like, in terms of stereotypes, like, mm-hmm. were they considered the same? Or, like, were they perceived? The same
way. I refer you to the work of Catherine Siniza Choi on this because her work is really exemplary. My sense is that no, not in the same way. And part of it was that to the degree to which U.S. missionaries and U.S. entities like the Rockefeller Foundation shaped nursing in India, they did much more so in the Philippines, right? And also nurses became a way out and there was kind of this professionalization thing going on. So my sense is that not in the same way. And that does point to specificity of the Indian context as well. But, you know, for example, when all foreign nurses entered the U.S. labor market in the 1960s, that was the time when it itself was desegregating for the first time. And so there was a re-racialization of the nursing workforce in the United States, and there was a shuffle where you got the creation of these categories, this hierarchy within nursing of nurses' aid, nurses this, that. And those are actually highly racialized and classed. Right, and so you know, at this time you had white women mostly as the RNs, some foreign nurses, but their ability to achieve RN status was always undercut by their immigration status too, and there was a kind of tenuousness around that. They had to pass all these tests. If they didn't do it within a certain time, they dropped out of the framework. And then black women were nurses' aides, right? So there's this thing that's going on, and these hospitals themselves are integrating at the same time that foreign nurses are entering in. And so the category of foreign becomes one of the categories within this reshuffling, right?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So you know how whenever there's more demand
uh-huh.
for immigration,
yeah.
there's always somebody trying to figure out how to come in around the legal limits, right?
Right.
So like paper sons existed, mm-hmm. and you know, in addition to the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering how did it become this thing where she's talking to Senator Simpson? Senator Simpson has does anyone know the history of Senator Simpson?
Not enough about it.
Not enough about it, but he's, maybe you can tell it.
No, go ahead.
I would say Senator Simpson is known for being racist. I forget exactly what he did during, he did something about the internment, and also with reparations for the internment. I think it was he didn't support, I don't remember exactly, but I remember his name coming up often.
Well, she came to talk to him because she was testifying at the congressional hearings over immigration marriage fraud, and he was one of the presiding senators.
Okay.
So it's not like she went to him specifically to supplicate. It's more that he was on the committee, and then she was one of the people who, whoever it was, had pulled in to testify about her case as an example of how immigrants were misusing the spousal reunification in the immigration law. Yes, that's how that came to be. Those quotes are all straight from congressional testimony.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So you can look them up on record over the immigration marriage fraud hearings, so right before 1986.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how extensive was the marriage fraud? Because, like I said, there's all kinds.
Uh-huh. It depends. I think the problem is with the conception of fraud in marriage.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the reasons why some people marry for healthcare, some people, I mean, like, you know,
yeah.
Like, what constitutes fraud?
Right.
Like, you know, some idea of love, some romantic idea of, like, why people get married is
right.
Legitimately.
Yeah, there's always resistance. So, like, mm-hmm. Different kinds.
Right. And so this whole, like, stereotype of Asians as in arranged marriages, is that fraud? To have an arranged marriage? No. But so, you know, and the forms of reasons why people get married here don't get scrutinized in the same way. So I think that the idea of prevalence is second to that question of, like, what is even getting framed as fraud versus what isn't. Yeah.
So if the guy hadn't left her,
mm-hmm.
the marriage was a sham,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't be fraud.
Who knows?
The fraud was that he walked away and said he wanted to have nothing to do with her?
I think the fraud was that quote where he was like, I'm going to bring my whole family and we're going to bring the Brown Empire here.
And they did it to get a green card.
Yeah. Right. As in, I didn't do it out of love, and apparently people who are really, like, true only get married for love and no other reason, right? And so,
all kinds of reasons, right?
Right, and love is one of them, certainly, but, you know, also so are structural factors, like our tax break or whatever, you know, like, you know, we don't want to pay two rents anymore. I mean, I don't know, you know, but these things, like, factor and they don't get framed the same way, right? But in this case, it's like, oh, no, these people are fraudulent because they have other things on their mind than romance. But I think the reason why they're framing him as fraud is that, like, you know, these women are so easily duped that, like, all these men are coming in through them, and that's the new vector for invasion.
You probably talk about this, and I missed that when you talk about the shifting power between British and America. So was the U.S. a more desirable destination for these women on the
nurses? You know, just when U.S. immigration law was opening up, British law was closing down. And so that's part of the shift. Many nurses, especially in the 80s with the opening of the Gulf economy, and many nurses, especially from Kerala, are chain migrants. So they would go first to the Persian Gulf and or Europe and then come to the U.S. or Britain. I did meet nurses who did that. But the general class dimensions of South Asian post-World War II migration to Britain was more working class, and it was more professional managerial in the U.S. in those initial decades of the 60s, 70s. And 80s, and that has to do with the occupational preferences in the U.S. and has to do with racist anti-immigration politics in Britain that were going on at the same time. So that's a little bit of the difference. But yeah, some of them did go to England, and some of them did go to Europe, and some of them did go to Australia, and a lot of them went to the Persian Gulf. But in the Persian Gulf, the reason why a lot of them didn't stay or kept migrating was that you can't reunite your family there. You can't settle there. You're only ever a temporary migrant. And so if they wanted to actually, like, shift their lives, the long-term solution couldn't be there, unless you wanted to live a back-and-forth life between South Asia and the Persian Gulf. Yeah.
Thanks very much for the talk. I have a question about the historical legacy that you mentioned of this tension between women on the loose and women in the lead, going back to the 19th century British Empire and the import of the hospital nurse model by U.S. medical missions, if I understood correctly. I'm wondering if or if you could elaborate on how conversion to Christianity figured into this tension. Did it help alleviate tension among the Indian indigenous population to convert to Christianity? Did it exacerbate it? Did it figure at all?
I totally figured. I mean, what happens is, so one of the issues that Protestant medical missionaries or any missionaries in general in India faced to them, to their view, is that they were only ever able to attract predominantly oppressed caste and class Indians. So they had this real kind of quest for the upper privileged caste Indian, but most of who they were getting were people who were Dalits, of course, who wanted to, like, you know, to convert out of one situation into another. So the fact that the majority of Indian Christians were converted from the oppressed caste, just because they converted doesn't mean that the view of them changed overall. It's different in different states. Kerala, which has a Syrian Christian population which predates European colonization, and so the configuration of Christianity there is actually different. And so, and that's where a lot of these nurses come from. So there's a little more of the, you know, nurses are a good, you know, a good thing, especially because they became one of the primary ways that people, families got out of Kerala and into the global labor force. But a lot of the stigma around Christianity and conversion stayed because of the stigma around caste. But at the same time, it wasn't just the stigma around caste. It was the fact that they continued to be in poor working conditions, underpaid, stigmatized and racialized by missionaries, to all of this compounded together. So it wasn't just caste alone, but it's certainly a factor. Yeah, I don't know if that answered your question enough, or there's more. Yeah, and you know, as a minority in India, the Christian community also has its own history, but the majority of immigrants are Christians too. It's, you know, but I interviewed, when I did my sample, I made sure to interview Hindu nurses too. I didn't get a Muslim nurse, but I made sure to interview not just Christian nurses to see if there were. So, for example, Dr. Khanna is a Hindu, and part of the stigma was that Hindu girls don't go and do that. Christians do, because they don't have the same prohibitions around caste, right? So, whereas we retain those prohibitions around caste, so you can't go do that work. So, there's a recasting of that work as that occupation.